Chapter 14. The bulky crawler paused on the pad in front of the big door, coming to a full stop and going through a series of safety checks before entering the garage. In the garage control center, the chief engineer swore when the exterior cameras monitoring the entire garage end of the wing glitched, froze, glitched again, and then failed. Those damned circuit failures, the engineer cursed to himself. They have now somehow affected the independent power supply of the garages. He made a mental note to add that to the long list of tasks his overworked team needed to fix. After a brief discussion, the base duty officer gave permission to open the garage door even though external sensors had failed in that area. After all, they had seen the crawler halted in front of the door, and communication with the two crew members assured they were waiting for permission to engage the drive again. When the door began sliding upward, there was another damned glitch. The door shuddered, stopped, and had to be brought back down to restart the procedure. Between the cameras being out and the door taking much too long to open, no one inside the base saw two figures in Krestang-powered armor leap out of the crawler's side door and race around the end of the garage wing. By the time the garage door resumed its now smooth upward movement, the crawler's side door was shut, and no one outside the crawler could have known the door was unlatched and ready to swing aside. When permission was given for the crawler to enter the garage, it did so painfully slow, irritating the waiting personnel, except for the chief mechanic, who appreciated that the drivers were taking care not to make the damage worse. Although, the engineer thought to himself, that was odd. Even in an enhanced view from the garage bay's internal cameras, the treads did not have any visible damage. None at all. For the crawler to be moving so unsteadily, the damage must be inside the drive mechanism, which was going to be a huge pain in the ass to fix. Replacing treads, even the entire tread assembly, was a relatively quick and simple job, but getting access to the drive unit required lifting the vehicle off its treads and removing covers across the entire bottom of the crawler. The vehicle would be out of service for 2 full days. Suddenly, the chief mechanic's day had gotten much worse.
"Do it, Skippy," Captain Poole urged.
The crawler had ground to a halt inside the garage bay, and the big outer door was sliding down. A maintenance team would be walking through the pressure door at the far end, and it would look suspicious if the two dead former drivers did not open the crawler's side door and step out to report.
"Doing it," the beer can's voice came through her helmet speakers, the sound slightly muffled as he had to speak through the moon base's comm system.
"It would be easier if your end of the micro-wormhole were still there in the crawler with you."
"You know why Colonel Smythe had to take the wormhole with him," Poole snapped. "Can you do it or not?"
"Yes, yes, it looks good. Remember, there will be a surge when I start the power flow, a big surge, and I can't conceal it."
"I don't care if you can conceal it, so long as you can explain it to the bird brains."
"Doing my best here."
The chief engineer was about to step away from his console when it lit up from a power spike.
"What was that?"
he demanded of the base control center. Damn it. He had enough problems without some idiot trying to send power through a system that was cut off.
"This wing is powered down. It wasn't anything my team did."
"Hold one,"
a harried voice responded from the control center. The team there had noticed the power spike also, and a quick check determined the power had not come from any system connected to the base's infrastructure. The duty officer was about to order a full diagnostic plus a security alert when a message was received from the research base on the planet below.
The voice from the control center reported. "Looks like the research facility conducted a test that was more successful than they expected."
That astonished the mechanic.
"A test on the planet caused a power spike up here? Did the planet explode?"
"The planet is intact," the officer said with irritation. "You will need to inspect critical systems for damage, starting with the main weapons."
"Of course I will," the engineer groaned.
First, though, he was going to have a little chat with some asshole down on the planet. Except, no, he wasn't, because the damned comm system was down. What else could go wrong? The chief engineer had no way of knowing that the comm system itself was in perfect working order. The problem was that the entire base was encased in a powerful stealth field which bounced back all outgoing signals and caused incoming signals to wrap around and be absorbed by the field. While the crew of the moon base worried about the effect of the power surge coming from the planet,
Sensors on the planet and both orbiting battle stations had also noticed a power spike coming from the moon base, and all three facilities contacted the moon base to find out what was going on. The circuit failures that had thrown Colonel Smythe's careful plan out the window provided a convenient explanation, an explanation that was almost too convenient. The problem was that Skippy thought using the circuit failures was way too obvious and boring and dull, and he could come up with a way more entertaining and clever explanation that would finally show that smug jerk-faced Joe Bishop that monkeys are not the only beings in the galaxy able to dream up clever ideas. Thus, the reply from the moon base was delayed for an amount of time barely noticed by the meat sack boss Farrakh, but long enough to cause alarm in the AIs running the planetary base and the two battle stations. The delay was caused by Skippy arguing with that killjoy pain-in-the-ass Nagatha about whether he should just get on with it and explain the power spike by using the circuit failures or the original excuse of a reactor problem, or anything, so long as the beer can got his figurative ass in gear right now before his insufferable arrogance doomed the whole operation. The argument raged for nearly 2 nanoseconds before the smartest being in the galaxy huffed that, after all, he had better things to do than argue with an overgrown communications submind that he created. A reply was sent from the moonbase, with none of the three recipients aware they were talking with a beer can aboard a pirate ship hiding behind the moon. One of the battle station AIs, who was not convinced that cascading circuit failures could cause a power spike of the type detected, prodded the station commander to investigate the incident, and the station commander announced she was sending a dropship over to the moon. Rather than being insulted, the moonbase duty officer replied they actually would appreciate help diagnosing the problem, so could the station include an engineering team aboard the dropship? Skippy did not bother informing anyone on the star team that a dropship would be coming to the moon, figuring the operation would be over one way or another by the time the dropship was ready for launch. If not, one puny dropship would not make a difference anyway. Right? The garage bay was pumped full of air again, which made Lauren Poole wonder if having the air filtered made any difference to the pungent smell of any place occupied by the boss Farrakh. That stray thought flashed fleetingly through her mind as she watched the inner pressure door open and three boss Farrakh technicians stroll out, their seemingly backward-bent legs making them awkward to her view.
On my signal, she took a calming breath. 3, 2, 1.
The chief engineer's most frequent complaint was that he was too often left out of the loop, or informed too late after everyone else already was aware of a problem. One technician had made a habit of delaying reports about problems because he was always sure he could fix the issue before it needed to be brought to the chief engineer's attention. After the third time the chief engineer heard about an issue through the base commander asking when the engineering team was going to fix something, that technician had been reassigned to the most awful duty station in Boss Farrakh territory. And since then, incident reporting had improved measurably. That day, the chief engineer could not complain about being the last to know, because he was first to receive notice of an alien assault. That notice came in the form of an explosive-tipped round penetrating his breastbone and plunging another 2 centimeters into his chest cavity before detonating, ripping his torso nearly in half. In perspective, perhaps being first to know about the alien assault was not such a good thing.
"Go, go, go!" Poole whispered, knowing her orders would be magnified by the team's helmet speakers, and knowing that the effort of shouting might move her head and throw off her aim.
Her first shot, leaving the muzzle of her superb Kristang rifle while she was on one knee in the airlock while the crawler's side door was still opening, had taken out her first target, a scowling enemy officer behind glass windows in a gallery overlooking the garage bay. A useful feature of the rifle was that, almost without Poole having to do anything, it sent a targeting pulse combination of laser beam and particle beam to assess distance to and any obstructions between the rifle and the designated target. Return pulses indicated the target was behind a clear composite material, so the rifle switched to a mode the star team called double-tap penetration. 2 rounds left the muzzle when Poole depressed the trigger, the first engaging its light armor penetrating mode, burning a hole through the clear composite for the explosive-tipped kill shot only 10 centimeters behind along the same flight path. Technically, the first notice received by the chief engineer was in the form of hot droplets of plasma and melted composite splattering his chest, but that hot pain signal had not enough time to reach his brain before the second round impacted and exploded, and he ceased to exist. So,
Close enough. And it's not like that boss Farrakh cared about the particulars of his death anyway. Rising smoothly from one knee to a standing position without taking a step forward or taking her eyes off her targets, Poole remained in the side doorway as the team rushed past her and down onto the garage bay floor. Even before the door opened, she had selected targets in sequence, using the crawler's exterior sensors to pre-program her rifle. She swung the rifle right to left, firing above the heads of the racing star team and taking out 6 targets in 4 seconds. Her last action before hopping out of the crawler to join her team was to activate the undermounted rocket launcher by flicking her right pinky finger, sending a rocket set to fragmentation mode through the shattered composite into the gallery above the garage bay. On the way into the garage, the crawler's sensors had detected additional people in the gallery, but they were out of her line of sight and had escaped the tender, loving care of rifle rounds. The rocket made sure the unseen aliens in the back of the gallery, who were scrambling toward the rear door, did not feel left out of the action. After the nose cone of the rocket crossed the plane where the composite windows had been, its laser sensor created a 3-dimensional map of the gallery, detecting 3 moving objects who were approximately the size and shape of adult boss Farrakh. Accordingly, after traveling forward another 2 meters for an optimal spread pattern, the rocket detonated its warhead, sending hot, razor-sharp fragments in a 130-degree cone and slicing the 3 unprotected aliens into squishy bits. Good, Poole acknowledged the rocket's final report. Sensors built into the rocket observed and recorded the deaths of the 3 fleeing targets and relayed that data back to Poole's suit, which happily showed her a summary in the bottom left of the display. 6 confirmed kills from rifle shots, plus 3 from the rocket, was 9 less enemy to worry about. That left only, if Skippy's count could be trusted, 68 enemy to be dealt with inside the moon base. Lauren Poole certainly did not trust the beer can's official count, because the AI was likely to have absent-mindedly lost track while he was counting, or just lost interest halfway through the count and decided that fudging the number was good enough for monkeys. Or he knew the real count and decided to amuse himself by screwing with the star team. All Lauren knew for sure was the moon base was a target-rich environment and her team needed to kill anyone along the way to their objective, then possibly clear the base room by room to hunt down and kill or disable any survivors. Her team was already ahead of her, the last person disappearing through the pressure door as she sprinted to catch up. Her helmet display showed her the position and status of each team member, and she could toggle between views from their helmet cameras and suit sensors so she could have led the team while she remained inside the crawler. With her team consisting of only 2 other soldiers, she represented 1/3 of the team's combat power. No, that was not quite true. Her team also included 1 of the 2 weapon-equipped Therannan Combots, and that machine by itself had more firepower than 3 soldiers, even 3 soldiers wearing Krystang-powered armor suits. The boss Farrakh inside the base were not a major concern because, ironically, the massive firepower of the facility had left the bird brains vulnerable to the only type of attack that could actually threaten them, an enemy force gaining access to the base from the ground. The strong layers of energy shields, plus the offensive weapons installed under the moon's surface, rendered the base practically invulnerable to attack from above. Enemy ships seeking to bombard the moon base would be sliced in half by the base's weapons, and anything sneaking up on the base by hugging the surface would be easily targeted by the 2 orbiting battle stations or by the weapons of the research base on the planet's surface. With the 4 facilities supporting each other, they could hold off any attack until the boss Farrakh fleet could be summoned. All the crews needed to do was hunker down behind their powerful energy shields and wait for the enemy to decide they had taken enough punishment. That unimaginative thinking is why the moon base had only 8 people on the security team, and why most of the personnel did not carry or even have access to infantry weapons. An assault on the moon base was considered unlikely in the extreme, for the only valuable asset in the star system was the atomic compression research base down on the planet. Any ground assault against the moon base would come only after the base's defenses had been destroyed by bombardment. And with the base's weapons offline, what would be the point of risking soldiers to pick through the rubble? The prevailing thought was the base would never, could never, be attacked from the ground because with the base fully active, no enemy ground force could get through the sensor network that extended far from the base in every direction. Regular testing assured the boss Farrakh that their sensor network could detect even a stealth object the size of a small missile before it even entered orbit around the moon. And that is why the base security team had a high turnover of personnel.
No one wanted such dull duty with no chance of action or opportunity to distinguish themselves. According to records accessed by an arrogant beer can, the security team that had an authorized strength of 8 was only staffed with 5 Boss Farrakh at the time the Star Team entered the garage, and one of those 5 was combat ineffective while being treated for a broken leg. The base's robotic defenders, generally heavier and larger than the Star Team's Theranan Combots that were designed for use aboard the confines of a starship, were, according to official records, a formidable force. In reality, most aspects of the moon base and the 2 orbiting battle stations had been constructed quickly and cheaply, because the Boss Farrakh military had little confidence in their scientists' ability to make atomic compression devices in useful quantities. Therefore, other than the truly powerful defensive energy shields and weapons, the moon base was built of second-hand and second-rate materials. That is why electrical circuits kept failing, and why the chief engineer had to prioritize the efforts of his maintenance team. Shields and weapons and other systems the base commander directly engaged with got priority. Combat robots, which were nothing but useless, showy toys in the opinion of the chief engineer, went to the bottom of the priority list. When the base commander insisted on a security drill, the security leader knew to select the only 4 functioning combots, the others all having failed due to lack of maintenance or having been stripped of parts to keep 4 units ready. On rare occasions when the base commander looked in the armories where the combots were stored, he saw shiny and lethal weapons that would protect his base. He had not seen the shiny things actually moving. The Star Team did not know the status of the enemy's killbots when they entered the base, so they had to assume they might be facing 18 killing machines rather than 4. After Skippy gained access to the base's main computer, he could deactivate the enemy killbots, or at least sever them from the control circuit and render them useless. Until the beer can could work his magic, the humans, and even their own combots, would be vulnerable, so the routes the teams took to their objectives were planned to avoid going past armories where enemy killbots were stored, and to avoid killing zones where the teams could be pinned down. Speed meant everything. Speed was life. Nothing could be allowed to stop or slow down the 2 teams, and the pirates would hold their combots in reserve for use against the robotic killing machines of the Boss Farrakh. Poole was already unhappy about Smythe and Frey jumping out of the crawler before it entered the garage, and to maintain communications secrecy she had not heard from either of them since they disappeared around the end of the garage wing. They could be alive, they could be dead. But one thing Poole was certain of was that splitting an already small force went against the principle of concentration of force, not that there was anything she could do about it right then. Racing through the pressure door, her right shoulder glanced off the wall there in a move calculated by her suit as the best way to turn the next corner. Having a suit that anticipated her needs and acted without her input or permission could be useful. It could also be dangerous. Skippy had enhanced the computer of her suit so it learned the particular biomechanics of her movements and knew how she moved in different situations, able to switch its power assist from an easy fuzzy slippers on the couch mode to full panic mode when needed. Poole might have described the current operating mode as high speed, grateful for the ability of the suit's smart brain to keep her upright and moving along the pre-selected route while her own meat sack brain was busy with more important matters like aiming her rifle. Nunnally and Roe had each taken their 3-person teams to the left and were no longer in her line of sight. Ahead of her was her team, with the combat taking up the rear. Someone had splattered a bird brain all over a wall, and parts of the body were making the floor slippery. Her suit took care of keeping her footing as she leaned to the left to squeeze by the combat. Movement in a hallway to the right caught her eye, and she reacted, swinging her rifle while her left pinky finger selected a 3-round burst mode without her even thinking about it. The threat was a Boss Farrakh wearing the robin's egg blue coveralls of a maintenance technician. The bird-like alien's mouth and eyes were wide open in fear if its body language was anything like a human, and it held a small cylinder-like thing in both hands, bringing the device up toward Poole. The thing could have been an oddly bulbous and short rifle. It could have been a rocket launcher. It could have been a fire extinguisher. It could even have been a Boss Farrakh sex toy for all Poole cared. She wasn't waiting to satisfy her non-existent curiosity. Curiosity killed the cat, but a 3-round burst killed the alien and snapped the device in half, sending it spinning back down the hallway in a showering spray of white foam. Huh, some part of her brain thought. So it was a fire extinguisher. Unless it was a sex toy, in which case she would rather not know.
On your left, she announced to the combat, though the words were not necessary. The thing had sensed her intention and moved to the right to give her room to run by. Once past the hulking machine that stomped along dutifully behind her, she took up position just off the right shoulder of Rourke, with Burke 3 meters ahead in a cover formation. The three were racing along a hallway, ducking slightly to avoid cracking their heads on doors that had tried to slide down to seal the invaders from the main part of the base, doors that had suffered mysterious glitches that jammed them only slightly down from their normal recessed position. Inside her helmet, Poole smiled without realizing, pleased to see that whatever the fate of Smythe and Frey, the beer can had been able to interfere with the moon base's power systems. Burke, in the lead, sprinted at nowhere close to the suit's full speed, as the hallway jogged left then right at odd places, preventing a full-on sprint. Twice he fired his rifle, and twice Lauren saw kills registered. She also noted he briefly aimed his rifle at a Boss Farrakh who was cowering in terror on the floor of a side hallway, but let the poor creature live, as he had more important things to worry about, and he would have had to skid to slow enough to bring his rifle to bear on target before he went by. With regret and advance notice, Lauren had her rifle ready as she passed that side hallway, sending 2 rounds into the terrified alien. She had an afterimage of the bird-like creature's head being separated from its body. Then she had to concentrate on swerving around a bend in the hallway in front of her. The ghostly schematic projected inside her faceplate showed they had traveled 2/3 of the way to the core of the base, where the control center was located, and the floor began to slope downward as expected. The point of greatest danger was just ahead, where a side hallway connected to the section of the base that housed the security team. In the original plan, Skippy was supposed to have established full control of the base computer before the team attempted to breach the core of the underground facility, but Poole had heard nothing from Smythe or the beer can, and the original plan had been shot so full of holes it no longer mattered what the team had optimistically dreamed about aboard the Flying Dutchman so long ago. Her job was to lead 2 soldiers and an advanced alien combat robot to seize the base control center before the Boss Farrakh could do something like launch a missile that would soar above the stealth field and alert the planet and battle stations that something was very wrong on the moon. That was her job, and she was going to do it whether the unreliable beer can could help or not. Even in the original plan, the already small star team had been split into 3 units, with Poole taking the 2 Marine Raiders with her to cover for Smythe and Frey on their mission to plug the beer can's presence into the moon base computer. The 3 Delta Force soldiers were operating as a team to avoid communication issues. They were tasked with stopping launch of fighters or dropships from the east hangar bay, while Nunnally, Grudzian, and Kloose were assigned to the west hangar bay. Poole appreciated that her team were all Americans, and her teammates were Marine Raiders who had served together. Nunnally, with a Polish and a German soldier, had perhaps the most potential for fatal miscommunications, but given the international nature of the Renegade Star Team, that could not be helped. She was grateful that the 2 Marine Raiders on her team knew each other and knew each other's tactics and worked well together. She would have preferred they not be named Burke or Rourke, because she had to speak their names carefully so one didn't think she was addressing the other. Burke put on a burst of speed as he approached the side hallway so he could clear the gap and provide fire support from the other side if needed. If the original plan had still been in effect, he would have had advanced warning of any threats through Skippy's control of the base computer, forcing that alien machine to feed internal sensor data to his Kristang suit computer. Instead, Burke had no idea what threat might be in the hallway ahead to the right. The fear of uncertainty, plus the hallway ahead being straight and wide for 50 meters without obstructions, allowed him to kick the suit's motors up into what the star team designated as chased by a bear mode, and he surged so fast his poor human vision had trouble keeping up. Behind Burke, Poole increased her own speed until she was running shoulder to shoulder with Rourke, wary that if the enemy were in the hallway to the right, they would be alerted by Burke's passage and looking out for attackers following him. Burke ran into the gap and was halfway across when he was struck from the right by an object that glanced off his hip, sending him tumbling and skidding out of control. "Stop!" Poole shouted, and her suit obeyed, Rourke's suit beside her doing the same. When the suit computers determined the boots alone could not halt forward progress before the danger zone, each suit fired a sort of harpoon backward out of the waist belt, the harpoon's point deflecting off the floor but deploying sticky nanofibers that adhered to the floor, holding the harpoon in place and jerking both soldiers to a stop on the end of the cable attached to their waist belts. Lauren Poole teetered on her toes, leaning so her helmet came close to the edge of the intersecting hallway, then the cable retracted to pull her backward. "Retract," she ordered, and both harpoons released their grips on the floor, being reeled back into their storage pack for later use. "Burke, you okay?"
"Fine,"
Burke grunted while bent over on hands and knees, his shaky voice sounding anything but fine. His rifle had been torn from his grip by the impact of crashing into the floor. The gecko-like material could have hung on to the weapon despite the violent action, but the suit's computer had scanned the hallway ahead, calculated how far it would and should tumble to protect its wearer, and determined the best option was to let go of the rifle. To avoid loss of the weapon, it was attached by a thin nanofiber tether to the right forearm of the suit, and Poole could see the tether already pulling the rifle back toward Burke as that soldier took a moment to regain situational awareness, which is a polite way of saying he barely knew who he was, forget about where he was. In her faceplate display, Lauren took in two vital pieces of information while ignoring the detailed data. Simple green indicators told her that neither Burke nor his armored suit had sustained serious or even significant damage from the enemy fire, so she was free to focus on the overall situation, which was bad. Very bad.
"Rourke, get the combat up here."
"On it."
Rourke's reply was not needed as the hulking machine, its weapons deployed and the energy shield crackling, was already creeping past Poole. She flattened against the wall to let the combat robot squeeze past her, then stepped in front of Rourke to cover the man who was somewhat vulnerable as he concentrated on guiding the combat. Lauren had trained as a combat driver, and it could be exhilarating to control such destructive power. It was also often too easy to get caught up in the combat senses and forget the need to care for and move the driver's own body, especially when the machine was in battle.
"Going for recon,"
Rourke reported as he used a finger to extend one of the combat's creepy tentacle-like probes around the corner to get a view of the side hallway.
"Looks like..."
Whatever Rourke was going to say was lost, as both he and Poole were blown backward, and the combat was slammed against, into, and then partly through the far wall. Poole had a snapshot impression of two or possibly three alien killbots in the adjacent hallway, with several Bosphorak behind. Only one of the enemy was wearing an armored suit. She was sure of that because she had seen the bird-like beaks of their bare faces. She was still spinning and sliding backwards on her ass, her body going limp to protect her delicate muscles and tendons as she had been trained, trusting the suit's computer to know when best to bring her to a stop so she could get back into action. While still tumbling, she steadied a replay of the incident on the right side of the display, her suit anticipating the information she most likely needed immediately. A small part of her brain marveled again at the incredible technology of Kristang armored mech suits. The truly amazing functions of the suit computer had been added by Skippy after he erased the original crappy operating system and worked his magic on what he had said was seriously, pathetically, hopelessly inadequate processing power and storage capacity. If the suit computer ran on something better than what Skippy described as a poorly assembled set of 1930s vacuum tubes, he might be able to make the suits do truly incredible things. But given the severe and totally unfair constraints he worked under, what could he do? The answer, Poole firmly believed, was as close to magic as she was ever likely to get. While she reviewed sensor data of the incident on the right half of the display and verified that Burke and the combat were still capable of effective operation, the suit halted its slide and flipped lightly upright to land her on her feet, automatically using reduced force in the moon's lower gravity.
"Oh, shit."
Poole did not know if she had said that aloud. She now knew what had happened. The enemy detected their combat's flexible recon probe when it peeked around the corner, and the enemy was not stupid. Their own killbot machines had instantly determined the probe had to be attached to something hostile and dangerous, and either on their own, or with their master's hasty permission, decided that firing right through the base's internal structure was the best way to deal with the threat. What had blown the Star Team's combat into the far wall and knocked Lauren and Rourke backwards was a spread of lasers cutting a circular hole through the walls, followed closely by a mix of armor-piercing and explosive-tipped rounds that her suit analyzed as being 12.3 caliber, as if she needed that info. Finally, at least two and possibly three rockets had struck the energy shield of her combat and penetrated that protection to strike the machine directly.
Her own analysis of the situation was her team facing two or more enemy-killing machines that were larger and more heavily armed and armored than the Theranan Combat with her, plus an unknown number of enemy soldiers, at least one of whom wore powered armor. She had three shaken-up, though uninjured humans, and a Combat that was extricating itself from being partly embedded in a wall. Blinking yellow icons told her the Combat had non-fatal damage. The fatal part was that if the machine was knocked out of action, her team would be facing overwhelming force with inadequate firepower. What should she do? Step 1. Prioritize the mission.
Burke, she ordered. Get to the control center and secure it. Go, now, now, now!
Burke may not have liked the order to split the team's combat power again, and he unquestionably did not like leaving two people behind to battle the enemy. He also did not question the order. His display had shown him the same data Poole used to make her decision, plus he had watched the incident and could see the still-smoking holes in the interior wall. Burke turned to run, feeling through his boots the vibrations of something, or some things, big and heavy, stomping down the side hallway. Step 2. Call for help? No, the other teams could see her situation through the team's tactical link, and she knew Smythe was monitoring her, although his suit was not transmitting any data so his position could remain concealed. Through the TAC link, she could see Nunnally's team was also fully engaged and not able to assist. The Delta team was already halfway across the base and had their own difficulties to deal with. Smythe and Frey, with the all-important micro-wormhole, she had no idea where they were. Step 2 could not be requesting backup. What then? That was easy. Step 2 was going to be the old reliable blowing shit up. She eye-clicked a targeting order to her rifle's rocket launcher and pulled the lower trigger to authorize a weapon. Electromagnets sent the rocket down the tube without firing the engine, and the weapon's thrusters spun it in the air to curve around through the gaping hole in the wall. The last image Poole had of the rocket was the flare of the motor kicking in as it flew back down the path the enemy had created with their own weapons.
Rourke, Combat to suicide mode!
If she and Rourke were going to die that day, they were going to take a whole lot of alien MFers with them.